Shalom and welcome to Rambam Yomi. This is Rabbi Mati Novik. Join me as we learn the Rambam's Mishneh Torah, one perek each day. Now that we have completed the Rambam's presentation of the 39 Melachot, including an extended discussion of the laws of Hotzah over 7.5 prakim, we pause before continuing in Hilchot Shabbat to return to some topics related to the Melachot which deserve deeper scrutiny. This year we'll focus on three topics: milking animals on Shabbat, the concept of grumma and its various applications, and the basics of how an eruv functions to allow carrying in an urban area. Hopefully, we will return in a later shiur to another question which arose in the last prakim, namely the status of electricity and electrical appliances on Shabbat. We saw in Perek Chet that milking an animal is a melacha d'oraita of mefarik, a tolda of dash. This din has its source in the Tosefta, in the name of Rabbi Eliezer, and whereas most Rishonim agree with the Rambam that this is an Isser Doraita, the Rashba believes that the Chachamim disagree with Rabbi Eliezer and consider milking an animal to be Asur Midrabanan. He reaches this conclusion based on the principle of Ein Disha Ela Begidulei Karka, which seemingly excludes animals from the entire Malacha of Dash, including its Tolda of Mefarik. We discussed when we learned Perek Chet two ways to resolve the seeming contradiction between the inclusion of milking as an example of mefarik and the principle of Ein Disha Ela Begidulei Karka. So the Rashba's opinion that milking is only Asur Midrabanan is a third resolution, and a fourth is the novel opinion of Rabbeinu Tam, quoted by the Rashba, who claims that while mefarik is usually a tolda of dash, in the case of milking an animal, it is a tolda of mimachik, smoothing, as the act of milking smooths the surface of the animal's udder. The prohibition against milking an animal raises the concern of Tsar Bali Chaim, as a cow which needs to be milked suffers great physical pain if it remains in the state for a long time. This was already addressed at the time of the Rishonim, and the Maharam Rutenberg ruled that one may ask a non-Jew to milk an animal on Shabbat in order to avoid Tsar Bali Chaim. The Shulchan Aruch in Siman Shin Hei accepts this psak, but adds that the milk removed from the animal by the non-Jew may not be used for the remainder of Shabbat. He adds the opinion of a Yesh Omrim that the milk must be purchased from the non-Jew for a small sum to avoid the impression that the non-Jew did malacha for the benefit of the Jew. But what can be done if there is no non-Jew available on a regular basis to milk the cows? This question arose when dairy farms began to be established in Eretz Yisrael in the modern era. And for reasons of both ideology and security, it was not considered feasible to rely constantly on the presence of a non-Jew to milk the cows on Shabbat. The most ambitious attempt to solve this problem was made by Harav Ben Zion Meir Chai Uziel, the first Sephardi chief rabbi of Israel in the years just before and just after the founding of the state. Considering this a Sha'at Hadchak because of the critical importance of the milk industry for the economy and for the employment of the dairy workers, Rav Uziel was willing to rely on the opinion of the Rashba that milking a cow on Shabbat is only Asur Midrabanan. If milking is only Asur Midrabanan, then the additional factors of Tsar Bali Chaim and Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, both of which have Doraita roots, can permit it to be done even by a Jew. To soften the blow of this radical departure from the traditional halachic approach to milking on Shabbat, Rav Uziel limited his heter to situations where there is no non-Jew available, and he required that the milking be done with a shinui and only a little at a time. As to be expected from such a novel ruling, the lenient psak of Rav Uziel encountered strong resistance from most other halachic authorities. We saw when we learned Perek Chet that squeezing fruit, also an example of mefarik, may be done when the juice is squeezed into food, as in this case the juice isn't seen as liquid, but as part of the food into which it is squeezed. We mentioned that in principle this should apply to milking too, though the Shulchan Aruch limits this application to Yom Tov, when the milked animal itself can also be viewed as food, because shechting is permitted on Yom Tov. But some Rishonim believe that milking an animal directly into food is permitted even on Shabbat, and this provides the basis for another possible heter to use in dairy farms. Practically, how can all the milking in a dairy farm be done directly into food? By putting a small amount of food at the bottom of a large bucket, which won't ruin the milk entering the bucket, and which can be removed after the milking is done. This solution was suggested by some poskim, but rejected by others, like the Chazon Ish, due to the fact that it is too much of a ha'arama. the entire heter of milking into food is that we view the milk as secondary to the food. But this is obviously not the case when a large quantity of milk smothers a minute amount of food, which is only present in the first place in order to allow the milking. The Chazon Ish suggested that milking on Shabbat in order to alleviate Tzar Bali Chaim may be permitted if the milk is allowed to go to waste. This can be considered a shinui in the manner of milking, as well as a melacha shenetzricha lagufa. According to most Rishonim, not including the Rambam, melacha shenetzricha lagufa is only asur midrabanan, and therefore may be overridden in order to avoid Tzar Bali Chaim. But here as well, the Chazon Ish did not allow relying on this heter unless there is no possibility of having a non-Jew milk the cows. Another disadvantage with this approach, of course, is that all the milk that is taken out on Shabbat ends up going to waste. The advent of milking machines in the last several decades has introduced a new potential leniency into any discussion of milking on Shabbat. The machine can be set up, and all the person needs to do is attach the suction mechanism to the udder of the cow. If the first drops go to waste, the flow can be subsequently adjusted so that the remaining milk flows to storage containers. The only direct human action is attaching the machine to the cow, and the milk which comes out as an immediate result of that act goes to waste. The subsequent adjusting of the flow so that the remaining milk goes to storage is not an act of milking, which from that point on is performed by the machine. The Sefer Shmirat Shabbat Kehilchata records that this was the standard practice even in very observant dairy farms in Israel for many years, and the Chazon Ish, though objecting to the practice in principle, allowed it when the alternative was the great financial loss of having all the milk go to waste. More recently, two developments have introduced better solutions to the question of milking on Shabbat. Israel has a large number of foreign workers, and so finding a friendly non-Jew to milk the cows or activate the milking machines is not as difficult as it was in earlier days. In addition, the technology behind milking machines has advanced, and the milking itself, as well as redirecting the flow of milk from waste to storage, can be done now in a manner which is more indirect and qualifies as grumma. We turn now to a broader discussion of the principle of grumma and its applications on Shabbat, and we'll return to explain how it is used in milking animals. The Mishnah in Masechet Shabbat Daf Kuf Chaf describes a case in which a spreading fire may be put out indirectly by placing clay barrels of water in its path. The fire, when it reaches the barrels, will cause them to burst and will then be extinguished by the water in the barrels. The Rambam quotes this din in Perek Yud Bet. The Gemara refers to this case as gram kiboy, extinguishing by indirect action, and it emerges from this case that performing a melacha indirectly is not asur midoraita, and is indeed permitted, at least in certain cases. The Rama rules that we may only rely on grama to do melacha on Shabbat in cases of great financial loss, like the case of the spreading fire. Achronim discuss at great length what exactly qualifies as grumma, and how to distinguish between direct and indirect melacha. We will focus on specific applications of grumma, and the principles which underlie their use. The most common application of grumma is the use of the Shabbat clock, to cause a melacha to be done at a certain time, like activating a light or a hot plate, or turning one off. It is entirely permitted to set up a Shabbat clock before Shabbat, as this doesn't involve any human intervention during Shabbat itself. But what about adjusting a Shabbat clock during Shabbat by moving its pins up and down, so that a melacha will be performed earlier or later? This is an especially common question after an electricity outage, which throws off the timing of a Shabbat clock. Poskim discuss whether adjusting a Shabbat clock is similar to adding oil to a lit candle or removing oil from a lit candle. In these cases, too, the increase or decrease in the amount of oil produces no immediate change, but will eventually cause the candle to extinguish later or earlier than it otherwise would have gone out. And yet, as we saw in Perek Yud Bet, adding oil to a candle is a violation of mavir, and removing oil is a violation of mechabeh, so these are not considered grumma at all. Nonetheless, many poskim distinguish between an act on the candle itself, even if the effects are only felt later, and an act on a completely external system, like a Shabbat clock, which they believe qualifies as grumma. Most point out, though, that as we mentioned, the Rama only permits the use of grumma in cases of great need, and so adjusting a Shabbat clock should only be done in such circumstances. Many poskim, including Rav Avadya Yosef and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, distinguish between adjusting a Shabbat clock to prolong an existing state, like if the clock is now on but is set to go off in 2 hours, and it is adjusted so that it goes off only in 3 hours, and adjusting it to cause a change to occur sooner, like in the same case if the clock is adjusted so that it goes off in only 1 hour. The second is an example of grumma, which would be permitted only in a case of great need, possibly even for the benefit of a chole or a mitzvah purpose. But these poskim permit entirely the first case of prolonging an existing state. The rationale is that this is not comparable to adding oil to a lit candle, because electricity is constantly flowing through the wires which are plugged in, and the Shabbat clock merely blocks and unblocks the existing electric current. Adjusting the Shabbat clock to prolong a current state is more comparable to a case of a lit candle sitting near an open doorway, through which a wind will eventually blow out the candle if the door is left open. The Rama rules that one is permitted to close the door to prevent this from happening, and this is not considered mavir, even though it keeps the candle burning longer. According to these poskim, the Shabbat clock is the equivalent of a future wind, and prolonging its current state is like closing the door to block the wind, which isn't even an act of grumma. The Tzomet Institute in Israel, whose name is the Hebrew acronym of Tzivtei Mada V'Torah, Teams of Science and Torah, was founded in 1977 and has produced a wide array of electric devices which rely on grumma to perform activities which normally involve full-fledged melachot. Examples of these devices include telephones, electric wheelchairs, automatic lights and doors, and medical equipment. The exact mechanism by which these devices operate is typically one of two types. The first is called hasarat hamonea, removing an obstacle. This type of device is activated before Shabbat, and some element in the device blocks it from working. The use of the device on Shabbat involves removing this element. This sounds similar, and indeed is similar, to adjusting a Shabbat clock in a way which causes a change sooner, which we said before is considered grumma, which is only permitted in cases of great need. Therefore, many poskim only permit the use of devices which rely on hasarat hamonea for purposes related to medicine and security. And so these devices are typically suited for hospitals, police officers, and soldiers in the army. The second mechanism utilized by Tzomet is called hamshachat matzav, prolonging an existing state. This type of device activates automatically on its own every few seconds, and only for a fraction of a second. When someone turns on a device of this type, he isn't really turning it on at all, but merely preventing it from turning off the next time that it automatically activates. There is more room for leniency in the use of this mechanism than in the first one of hasarat hamonea, as here, the person is completely uninvolved in the activation of the device, and not even in an indirect manner, like removing an obstacle. Coming back to the topic of milking cows, the device created by Machon Tzomet for this purpose relies on the mechanism of hamshachat matzav. After the cow's udders are attached to the machine, and a regular timer turns the machine on, the milk which comes out goes to waste. An electric eye activates every few seconds, which, if it stays on, can switch the flow of milk from waste to storage. But it immediately deactivates after a fraction of a second, unless a certain switch has been flipped. A person flips the switch after the first milk goes to waste, thereby allowing the remaining milk to go to storage after the next time the electric eye activates. Though the mechanism of hamshachat matzav seems at first glance to be free of any problems, poskim raise concerns about the widespread use of grumma devices of any type. The Tzitz Eliezer and Rav Asher Weiss believe that because, from the perspective of the user, a switch is flipped and the device is activated, even if technically the mechanism is indirect or even involves prolonging an existing state, this does not qualify as grumma, but rather as a direct act, because it is perceived as such. Others see a slippery slope, in which every electric device can be built in a manner that operates through a grumma mechanism, with terrible repercussions for the general spirit of Shabbat, and even for Shabbat observance, as electricity would be perceived by the masses as something which isn't forbidden on Shabbat at all. Therefore, the use of grumma devices of any type is generally discouraged, except for medical and security reasons. But in these fields, they have found a wide variety of application, and most poskim encourage this trend, both in order to limit Chilul Shabbat as much as possible, when it is necessary at all, and in order to emphasize the sanctity of Shabbat, by having special devices for use on that day, whose purpose is to minimize the malacha which needs to be done. We move now to the topic of building an Eruv, to allow carrying in a neighborhood or a city. We begin by noting that the term Eruv is something of a misnomer. In order to permit carrying on Shabbat, two things are required. One, the entire area must be transformed into either a Reshut HaYachid, or, as we explained for the Rambam in Perek Yud Zayin, at least into a Carmelite with the types of walls which allow carrying, even if the area does not have the full status of a Reshut HaYachid. How this is done will be the topic of our discussion here. Two, even once the area has been transformed in this manner, carrying is only permitted if an Eruv Chatzerot is set up. This involves collecting food from the local residents and storing it in one of the homes, and we'll learn all about this when we get to Hilchot Eruvin. So the term Eruv is really only applicable to the second of these requirements, the Eruv Chatzerot. And yet, colloquial terminology has developed in which this word is used to refer to the setting up of walls and Tzurot HaPetach in the public domain. That is, to the first of the two requirements we described. We will follow the general custom and use this terminology, but we note that it is a relatively recent invention, and someone searching through the classic halachic literature for the laws relevant to our discussion here would need to look in Hilchot Shabbat, not in Hilchot Eruvin. We saw in Perek Yud Zayin Halacha Yud that the only way to allow carrying in a Reshut HaRabim, or a portion of it, is to build walls. For the Rambam, at least two parallel walls, and doors on the remaining two ends, which at least can be locked, even if they are not locked in practice. In the context of a modern city, building actual walls is typically not an option, and the only realistic way to surround the city is with Tzurot HaPetach, beams with strings above them arranged in the manner that we learned in Prakim Tet Zayin and Yud Zayin. But we seem to be presented with two significant challenges. One, as we just saw, Tzurot HaPetach don't suffice for a Reshut HaRabim. We would need to find a way to consider each of our cities and neighborhoods to be a Carmelite rather than a Reshut HaRabim. Two, even if an area is considered a Carmelite, is it then true that Tzurot HaPetach surrounding the area make it permissible to carry there? For the Rambam, both of these challenges indeed seem insurmountable, and the Rambam would not consider the vast majority of contemporary Eruvin to be valid. We begin with the second point. We saw in Perek Tet Zayin, Halacha Tet Zayin, that a Tzurot HaPetach can remedy a gap in a wall which is more than 10 amot wide, hence too long to be considered a petach. But even with that remedy, the mechitzot are only valid if they don't have the problem of parutz merube al ha'omed, where the Tzurot HaPetach counts as parutz. Hence it is clear for the Rambam that if an area is surrounded by a boundary consisting entirely or mostly of Tzurot HaPetach, this cannot possibly permit carrying, as the boundary is parutz merube al ha'omed. On this point, however, most Rishonim disagree with the Rambam and consider a Tzurot HaPetach to count as omed. Even an area encompassed solely by Tzurot HaPetach, according to these Rishonim and the Shulchan Aruch in their wake, is considered to be mukaf mechitzot, and it is permitted to carry inside it. Some, including the great scholar of the Rambam, Rav Yosef Kapach, believe that the prevalent understanding of the Rambam in Perek Tet Zayin Halacha Tet Zayin is incorrect, and that even the Rambam agrees that a Tzurot HaPetach is considered omeid and not parutz. In any event, the accepted view lahalacha is that surrounding an area with Tzurot HaPetach can permit carrying in a Carmelite. But this brings us back to the first of our two challenges. How can we consider a neighborhood or a city to be a Carmelite rather than a Reshut HaRabim, where all agree that a boundary consisting entirely of Tzurot HaPetach is ineffective? The only way to do this is by relying on the opinion of Rashi and Rishonei Ashkenaz, who consider the presence of Shishim Ribo, 600,000 people in daily traffic, to be a necessary condition of Reshut HaRabim. The basis for this condition is the fact that Reshut HaRabim is modeled on the encampment of Bnei Israel in the Midbar, and there Bnei Israel numbered 600,000 adult men. The later poskim debate whether most Rishonim accept this condition or not, but the Shulchan Aruch clearly brings it as a minority view and prefers the opinion of the Rambam and many others who believe that an area can be a Rishut HaRabim even without Shishim Ribo. If this condition is required in accordance with the Rishonei Ashkenaz, then until the last 150 years or so, it would have been virtually impossible to find a Rishut HaRabim anywhere. As late as the mid-19th century, even a city with population half the size, 300,000 people, would have been considered very big. Jews in Eastern Europe would rely routinely on the requirement of Shishim Ribo to classify their cities as Carmelite, and therefore carrying on Shabbat would be permissible once a city was surrounded by Tzurot HaPetach. Poskim of the 19th century debated the validity of Eruvin, which relied on this condition, with the Mishkanot Yaakov, Rav Yaakov Karliner, a student of Rav Chaim Volozhin, leading the opponents, and the Beit Ephraim, Ephraim Margolis, leading the defenders of the practice. As the reliance on Eruvin has become so entrenched in halachic practice over the years, it has become standard for modern poskim to allow them in most areas, even though the halachic basis for doing so is not as strong as we would usually require in questions related to the very serious matter of melacha on Shabbat. Nowadays, of course, there are large cities where well over 600,000 people travel on a given day, posing a problem even for those who rely on the criterion of Shishim Ribo. For this reason, Rav Moshe Feinstein felt that any Eruv in an area like Manhattan and Brooklyn is invalid. His understanding of the opinion of Rashi was that if there are 600,000 people in an area the size of the encampment of Bnei Israel in Midbar, then this area qualifies as a Rishut HaRabim d'Oraita. And indeed, this is the case in Manhattan, Brooklyn, and many other large urban centers. But Rav Menashe Klein felt that in the realm of Eruvin in large cities, where at stake is the ability of thousands of Jews to do such a basic activity as carrying outdoors, we must take pains to be as lenient as possible. He understands Rashi to mean that only when 600,000 people carry in one street is that street considered a Rishut HaRabim, and this is rare even nowadays. Furthermore, he believes that we may discount anyone who travels on the street in a car or other motor vehicle, as this is considered its own Rishut HaYachid, and hence the passengers are not considered to be located in the Rishut HaRabim through which they pass. We end by noting that we have not discussed at all the technical details of how to make a valid Eruv, a large topic in its own right, which relies on many of the principles of Tzurat HaPetach and Mechitzot in general, which came up in Perek Tet Zayin and Perek Yud Zayin. There are many books on this topic, both in Hebrew and in English, and the interested listener is referred to any of them for more details about how to build a proper Eruv. Thank you for joining me in learning today's Perek of the Mishneh Torah. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas you'd like to share, I'd be happy to hear from you. Send me an email at mtorahyomi@gmail.com. That's M as in Mishnah, Torah, T-O-R-A-H, Yomi, Y-O-M-I, @gmail.com. Come back tomorrow as we continue with our next parak.